Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, telling the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. On this episode, we chat to double Grammy-winning guitarist LJ Lawrence Juba. Described by Pete Townsend as a master, Lawrence has worked with the likes of George Harrison, Ringo Starr, Jeff Beck, Richie Sambora and Andy Williams, and has composed on films such as Good Will Hunting and TV shows such as Happy Days. In his spare time, Lawrence has also released 23 critically acclaimed solo albums. Despite that impressive CV, Lawrence is perhaps most prominently known for his studio and live contributions for none other than Sir Paul McCartney as lead guitarist in Wings. Today we will discuss his unique guitar techniques, what it was like collaborating with three of the Beatles, and Lawrence reveals what it was like to be in a band with Paul McCartney before and after John Lennon's untimely passing. As I sit in East London on a slate grey Victorian evening, Lawrence joins me on a live feed from sunny California. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Lawrence. How's it going?
I'm doing good. It's not quite so sunny today, though. Gee, I have a bit of rain coming through, which we sorely need. But yeah, mostly it's sunny.
Great.
One of the reasons I left London.
Yeah, that was one of my first things I wanted to get onto. So I'm actually recording this from East London. I've grown up in East London my whole life. You were born in Stepney, is that right?
I was. I spent the first 3 years of my life on Mile End Road in Stepney Green. And my dad was from Whitechapel. And then we moved out to Southgate. We moved out to North London. But when I was in college, I went to Goldsmiths College in New Cross, and I moved back and lived in Limehouse for the whole time I was there, about 3.5 years, down near kind of Burdett Road and Commercial Road around there, which had one of the benefits of having the best Chinese restaurant in London down the street.
Is it still there?
It looks like nothing, but I don't know. Apparently it's still there, but I haven't been back there in, you know, nearly 40 years, I think.
Right, okay. You're obviously gigging lots at the moment. I see that you've got many gigs this week, actually, I believe. How are you selecting the sets that you play each time? Do you think much about it now? You've got such a body of work. How do you choose which songs you're going to play?
Yeah, it's tricky because there are certain tunes that are just crowd-pleasing tunes. So they kind of don't really go away. They kind of are part of the core set. But I always cycle through stuff that is, you know, relevant to the new album, for example. I mean, and now with Fingerboard Road, which just came out, I've got Won't Get Fooled Again, you know, the Townsend tune. I've got Georgia, the Hoagie Carmichael tune. Both of those really kind of fit nicely in the set.
Acoustics differ in the venues that you play from your perspective, given that you've played at places like Royal Albert Hall. I know that you stood on the spot and played Little Wing where you once saw Jimi Hendrix play. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's exciting stuff, you know, and it's very different from playing, you know, a folk club or a jazz club. Some venues just have great PAs and great monitors, and others, you know, typically venues don't have a great live room sound. But then I'll play a concert hall that, you know, without a PA, more like a classical guitar player would. And then, you know, when you really feel the room. And typically, I would say that the European venues tend to be more concert hall type venues that have a built-in ambience to them. American venues aren't always designed, you know, to be ideal for an acoustic guitar.
Thank you.
when I'm playing, I tend to try and hear it from the audience's perspective. So the more the room gives back to me, the happier I am, because then I'm getting into that kind of audience ambience. But, you know, from a technical point of view, you just want to make sure that you hear enough of yourself, that I hear enough of myself that I don't overplay. Because if I overplay, then I just lose the dynamics, and I wouldn't want to do that.
Fantastic. Take us back then to, you know, when you were growing up in Stepney, and I think you got your first guitar aged 11, is that right?
Yeah.
11. Tell us about that. So that was obviously a guitar that was on your birthday, I think, given to you.
It was my 11th birthday, and by that time, of course, we were living in Southgate, and it was November 1963, and that whole year was just this steady kind of drumbeat of Beatlemania developing, and then there was the Stones and the Animals and the Dave Clark Five, and it just was, and it kept going. I mean, beyond 1963, it just never stopped, but that was kind of the beginning of that transition from the, you know, the Frank Ifields and the Springfields and the kind of the old school pop artists to the what in America they call the British Invasion. But of course, you know, we weren't invaded. It was it was all homegrown. And I just fell in love with the sound of the guitar from the shadows. I mean, from Hank Marvin's playing. I love that twangy guitar stuff and the way that it got used in the James Bond movies, you know, that 007 theme. And it was like, wow, this is really cool. And I want to do that. I want to play guitar. And then it was like, oh, how do I make a living doing this? And, you know, so eventually I learned that I could be a studio musician, and that then became my goal. But, you know, at age 11, it was just falling in love with the instrument.
You said at the age of 13, you realized you could make money doing this.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily young, and given it was only 2 years after you started picking up a guitar, are you a particularly fast learner?
I mean, I just spent a lot of time with it. I don't know that I was necessarily kind of a natural. It wasn't like, you know, by the time I was 13, I was kind of playing, you know, shredding on the instrument. I mean, I focused on it in terms of making music. And I still, to this day, you know, I consider myself a musician first and a guitarist second. I love the instrument and I love playing the instrument. But everything that I've done has been from a kind of a musical perspective, not purely a guitaristic perspective. So when I would listen to the Beatle records, I wouldn't learn the guitar solos note for note. I would try and figure out the concept behind it and then figure it out how I would do it myself. And that was true for most of what I was listening to as a teenager, which wasn't just guitar music. I mean, I would listen to orchestral music. My dad was a big fan of big bands. So I would just listen to whatever I could, you know, and slow the LPs down to 16 RPM and figure out what the notes were. And, you know, I discovered Bach, for example. There was a record called Lover's Concerto by a group called The Toys. I think it was a Motown record. And it was based on like Bach's Minuet in G major. And it was like, oh, this is interesting. And then that took me back to kind of looking at the classical origins of it. And then at school, we had music appreciation. So I was being exposed to all of that. And in those days, of course, there was no internet. There was no ability to just go to YouTube and kind of look something up. You really had to seek it out. And I just was so hyper focused on doing that. And then, you know, certain key points were like the John Mayall-Bino album, for example, where, you know, discovering Eric Clapton. And that was in one case. I mean, Hideaway in particular on that album was one that I learned note for note. But there was very little that I really went note for note. Like with Hendrix, it was just, how does he get that sound? How does, you know, what's the context of it? And throughout my teens, it was just absorbing as much guitar music, as much music in general, classical. I learned some classical guitar because I wanted to study. I wanted to do A-level music, and I couldn't do that without having like grade 8 or grade 6 or whatever it was, classical guitar. And the same thing, to go on to college, I needed, you know, something legit. And I was a terrible piano player, so It was really just study, study, and gig too. You know, making money playing in bands, top 40, playing. A local band leader adopted me when I was 13, and I started playing weddings and stuff like that. That was really how I learned about what it meant to be a studio musician, because I was working with older musicians who kind of, you know, were educating me about the business.
I'm particularly interested in that you learnt kind of sight reading skills at quite a young age, and I wonder what it was like then. I'd like you to explain to some of the people who are students that are going to be listening, because I teach occasionally at a music college, but I teach more about the psychology of learning as opposed to music theory. Students learning music theory is like people having to go in and do a German lesson as such. You know, it's a real anxiety and dread. And what would you say to those people? Because your career has relied perhaps a lot on being able to do that.
Well, it started with Bert Whedon's book, Play in a Day. You know, on one rainy London afternoon, I sat down, and in the back of the book was When the Saints Go Marching In, written out in notation. No tablature, it was just notation. And I saw the note C, and it showed that it was on the third fret of the fifth string. And I thought, okay, that goes there. And it was really just, you know, one step, you know, upon another for that. You know, and I was always fascinated by harmony. So I never, it feels like algebra. You know, it feels like something insurmountable. But the way that I kind of really absorbed it was, wow, that sounds great. What is it? Okay, so that's an F major 7 chord. How do I play that chord? Why does that sound the way it does? And so I've always kind of, my music theory, to a large extent, came from trying to understand what I was already appreciating. And so what I try, and when I do workshops and kind of do some teaching like that, I try and emphasize the fact that much of music theory is simply an explanation of what you already know the sound of. And then to take it from that point of view and be systematic about it, because so much of it is simply pattern recognition. You know, you recognize the shape of a triad. It doesn't matter whether that's on a C, a C sharp, a D, an F, F sharp, whatever note of the scale it's on. It's still the same pattern. It's still the same set of relationships. So there's a certain sense of kind of, if you can just feel the spatial relationships between the notes. Same thing with intervals. I mean, you know, there's a size to a sixth. There's a size to a fifth, and there's a tonality that goes along with that, and a feeling that goes along with that. An open fifth has a very different feeling to a fourth, you know, even though it's the same thing, but just inverted. There's just a quality to it. You know, it's like the beginning of Band on the Run, for example, is just, you know, dweet, 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 dweet. It's just parallel fourths. Well, you know, if you're a Wings fan, that's a great way of recognizing the sound of a fourth, you know. To me, it's what was always tough for me, especially in college, was ear training. You know, when to sit down and then start transcribing Schoenberg. You know, in one go, it's like, okay, they play you some crazy thing, and you got to write it down. You know, that's not the real world. The real world is being on a bandstand or on stage and being able to negotiate, you know, a chord sequence without having heard it before, but just, you know, understanding where chords go. You know, the five will typically go to the one, so you're in C on a G chord, and the band's playing a G, you pretty much figure it's either going to go to a C, an F, or an A minor. You know, sometimes you get, you know, caught out, but you kind of narrow down the options, because you just learn the sound of it. And I think that what's really important is to be immersed in music, and then the music theory makes sense, because it really is just explaining what you're already experiencing.
That's a tremendous insight. Thanks for that. That was great stuff. Okay. Tell us about the pressures we might not see being a full-time musician, things like touring and that kind of stuff. To many young musicians starting out, it's the dream job, but tell us, are there pressures that we don't see?
Well, you know, travel sucks. I mean, it's not fun. You know, but then if you've never been anywhere, going places is really cool. You know, when they come up with a Star Trek style, you know, transporter beam, so you can just get there. You know, that would be different. But travel is kind of, you know, goes with the territory. Crossing international borders with a musical instrument isn't always fun. And, you know, nowadays especially, there's a lot of pressure on musicians and artists to be self-managing in terms of their Twitter feeds, their Facebook feeds, all the social network stuff, that having to deal with their own merchandise. But, you know, the upside of that is you have more control than you do in the old days when, you know, the managers and the publicists and everybody was basically running the show, and you were lucky if you got paid at the end of the day. In terms of making hit records, I mean, you know, EDM has radically changed things, because so much of record making can be done on a laptop now. And, you know, electronic dance music is very much kind of a computer, you know, technology-driven genre. I mean, and same thing really with film composing and TV composing. It used to be that you had to, you know, sit down with score paper, write it out, you know, get a copyist, hire an orchestra, and go into a recording studio or a soundstage and record everything as quickly as possible, because it was costing you an arm and a leg. Now you can simply load up your Mac Pro with Omnisphere and all the East West, you know, Hollywood strings and stuff like that, and your orchestra is right there. You know, it's an electronic music box. Of course, it really helps to have had the experience of doing it with live players, and even, you know, things like digital editing. I mean, like the fact that you've got non-linear editing is great. I mean, I love to edit, but I learned to edit by cutting tape, so I learned the economy of editing as well. You know, it's like, it's just, but then I'm old school from that point of view, and I still listen to vinyl, and I still like to record analog if I can, because I just like the way it sounds and the way it feels. But the writing and musician and production world has changed so much. You know, it used to be that the songwriters would get the song and producers would get their producer percentage. And it doesn't work that way anymore. Now, the songwriters share the songwriting credit with the production team, which is why you can have 6, 7, 8, 9 writers listed on a song, because what used to be the province of union contracts and producer contracts and stuff like that is now, because there's no money that flows to that, it's all in the songwriting. So you program the kick drum, you get a piece of the song, which never used to happen. It never happened that way before. So, you know, as a music maker, if you want to be in the record business, you either have to be a really good top line songwriter, or you have to be really adept at having some kind of programming skill that you can add to your instrumental skills, so that you walk into a writing session and you're creating the track in the way that in the old school days the studio musicians would do that, which doesn't happen very much anymore. So it's a different era.
It's a totally different era, but it's an interesting one that you kind of live through both, and you're adapting along the way, which brings me nicely onto my next point about that. You've written songs on computer games, is that right?
Diablo. I worked on the score of Diablo 3.
How did you go about approaching that? Did you have a musical director, or did you?
Well, yeah, there is a musical director for Blizzard, who is the video game company. But they hired me because they wanted a composer who played guitar and could transition the musical style from the previous game, which was very 12-string guitar, hammer dulcimer, weird synth sounds kind of stuff, to a more orchestral approach. So I kind of bridged the gap between the two. But in the video game world, you don't operate in a vacuum. I mean, there are other elements, you know, there's sound effects and other elements that are integrated, you know, all the tones and drones and stuff like that, that get integrated into what you write. So it's a kind of a collaborative process. In terms of the songwriting end of things, I'm actually reporting not so much from my own point of view. My daughter Ilse is a songwriter, a top liner, as they refer to it now. And she actually has a record that's just being released. You know who Robin Schulz is? She co-wrote and is the featured vocalist on his new single, Headlights.
Right, okay.
And they debuted it on the Echo Awards in Germany, which is like the German Grammys, a couple of weeks ago. And it's getting really great reaction. But I see the world that she works in. And, you know, she had Pitbull's last single. I don't know how it did over there, but it was a big hit in continental Europe. A song called Fireball, she co-wrote that. And again, it's very collaborative. You know, you might have six people writing on a song, some of them just being programmers, but they're still part of the writing.
For new guitarists just starting up, describe what Dad Gad allows you to do that standard missionary tuning wouldn't.
Well, what DadGad allows is, well, for one thing, you have 3D strings and you have 2A strings, so you have all these octave correspondences. So there's a lot of symmetry, you know, the D A D G A D. So you've got A D, you know, you've got that A D twice. So whatever you do on the lower ones happens on the upper ones too. Anything you play on the sixth string, the fourth string, or the first string is all the same fingering, just different octaves. Same thing with the second and the fifth string. And then you also have this adjacent scale tone between the G and the A. And what that lets you do is do closed kind of cluster voicings. So you could play like an F add 2, where you play an F, a G, and an A, which are adjacent, you know, adjacent scale tones, but spread out over 3 strings and played like a harmony. It thickens the harmonic texture. And for some reason, this tuning just lends itself really well to pop song arranging. And it's, for me, it's very satisfying to be able to take something like Strawberry Fields Forever, or I Am the Walrus, or Won't Get Fooled Again, and find ways to express that on the guitar that you can't do in standard tune.
Fantastic, great insight. I'll try it this evening. I want to talk to you about obviously your relationship with Paul McCartney. You're the lead guitarist in Wings. You probably asked a lot about him, so I'm trying to think of a different angle. One of them is that I spoke to a guy I know who's a bass player, and he was telling me that John Lennon said that McCartney is the most innovative bass players ever and never got enough credit for his bass. And I just wondered, how did he differ from when you've played other bass players?
Well, I mean, you know, Paul is a multi-instrumentalist. He didn't start off being a bass player. He became the bass player by default because, you know, Stu Sutcliffe left the band. And he has something in common with another great bass player, who is Carole Kaye from the wrecking crew. Because, and there was a certain interaction there because, you know, Brian Wilson was encouraging Carol Kay to play more like McCartney, then McCartney's hearing Carol Kay on Pet Sounds and developing his bass playing, so it was kind of a synergy. You know, and James Jameson, the Motown bass player, was another big influence there. But Carol Kay is a guitar player who picked up the bass. And there's a certain similarity in the approach to picking. I think that what Paul excels at is creating a very melodic bass part. That there's tremendous counterpoint in what he's doing, and especially not just the riff-driven stuff, but you take something like Another Day, a song like Another Day, and you look at the way the bass line interacts with the melody, and it's really like kind of classical counterpoint. You know, for somebody who never studied classical counterpoint, it just proves that it's a natural process, and that, you know, he has that melodic ability. I think that the era that I worked in Wings, you know, especially the UK tour from 79, Paul was just playing such big notes and playing really hard, and he was playing a Yamaha bass at the time. It was like post-Rickenbacker and before he got back into the Hofner. And he just had this huge bass sound, and he was so locked with Steve Holly, the drummer. And you listen to the Beatle records, you listen to Drive My Car, and the way that Paul and Ringo were locked together. Because he understands the nature of a bass part. He's not just playing root notes, but he's playing the groove, and he's playing it with such attitude. And I think that, you know, the John's perception is very, very, very spot on, that Paul didn't necessarily always get the accolades. Same thing, Ringo, I mean, didn't get the accolades for his drumming, even though he's a brilliant drummer. You know, it's like when people ask me why Pete Best, you know, was kicked out of the band in favor of Ringo, I said, because Pete Best plays the drums, Ringo plays the song. And that's a big difference. And Paul plays the song. He's not just out there being a virtuoso bass player. He's playing what is absolutely essential, as they all did in the Beatles. You know, George played exactly what was right for the song. And I've worked with great bass players over the years, and they all the bass players admire Paul's bass playing. So, you know, it's if you know what's going on, then you have to give him all the credit for it.
You described Paul as a great teacher to you. Obviously, you're a teacher now. Is there one or two things that you might have picked up from him spring to mind?
Well, I mean, you know, there were the obvious things in terms of how to really get that Beatle-ish kind of rhythm guitar feel going on, and just playing very even eighth notes, for example, or even sixteenths, or mixed eighths and sixteenths, you know, which ultimately goes back to the Everly Brothers, which is where they, and Buddy Holly, which is where they were getting it from. But it was that kind of thing where it was, you know, it was a little tip here or there, just a nudge in the right direction. You know, I'm one of the tracks, a song called Love Awake, I played bass on, because Paul liked what I'd done on the demo, and he kneeled down on the floor and gave me picking techniques.
I love away. God knows we need it anytime we can get it. But we forget it.
But the broader perspective was that I learned by being there, you know, by being in the band and watching the process, and watching Jeff Emmerich or Phil McDonald or whoever was engineering with mic placement, and Chris Thomas kind of coming out and tweaking the volume on the guitar amp to a point where, you know, it was exactly the right amount of breakup, you know, so not too much, not too little, and how it all worked together. And you know, that was, and Linda too. I mean, I learned a lot from Linda, just, you know, talking with her and just seeing how Paul and Linda worked as a family making music together. It was a very broad kind of education. You know, so there were the specifics, you know, Paul sitting down, and all of a sudden with an acoustic guitar, he starts playing Michelle. And the second chord is not what the sheet music says it is. You know, if you were in C, play a C chord, and then the second chord is an F7 sharp 9, which, you know, the sheet music will tell you it's an F minor, but that's not what he plays. You go back and listen to the Beatle records, you can hear there's a major third in the backing vocals. And it's like those little, you know, little gleams of insight into the, you know, some of those things.
You obviously are a very big Beatles fan, so to work with Paul McCartney and Ringo and George, talk to me about the working relationship in regards to, if you're a young musician working with big personalities. Obviously, you're extremely professional, but, you know, being someone who's probably gone to see McCartney and been a fan of, and then kind of standing stage left and seeing him play Yesterday and that kind of thing, how did that affect you and how did you deal with that?
Well, I mean, here's a story. Very early on, when I was first started doing session work, I was working on a session with Cleo Lane and John Dankworth that George Martin was producing. And we were doing something in B major. And, you know, I was, you know, wrongly of the opinion that, you know, a studly guitar player would never use a capo. And so we're doing this thing in B, and I'm, you know, struggling through it with, you know, playing, you know, without a capo. And it's like, and you know, it took a little time, and I got the part, but I could have done it better and much quicker if I just, you know, capoed on at the fourth fret and played it in G, or at the second flat fret played it in A shapes. And George Martin was very patient and helpful, but it just is, you know, you there are skills when you start off, there are skills that you need that you don't necessarily know you need, because there was nobody to teach me, oh yeah, well, you know, make it easy on yourself. Walking into a session in London, probably 1977, and the producer says, "Do you have an electric mistress?" You know, I said, "Well, I'm married, actually." And it turned out, you know, that was like the pedal du jour, was the first of the flanges that were coming out, and as it happens, I didn't, but I kind of faked it with a wah-wah pedal and a phase shifter, and then right after the session went out and bought myself an Electro-Harmonic Electric Mistress. You know, so that kind of adaptability that if, you know, or for example, if there's, you know, all of a sudden it's like, well, we really need a banjo on this track. And of course, you know, you don't have a banjo. So what do? You know, you kind of mute the strings and, you know, play in a banjo-like fashion, kind of high up on the neck, and, you know, just tricks, you know, just to get you kind of through the session. And then I think that one of the things that was really kind of revelatory to me when I got into doing movie sessions in LA, for example, is that, you know, you sometimes, very often the guitar is in an isolation booth. And if you don't get your headphones on in time, you don't hear them call the cue. So, you know, it might be 2M7 and it's like, what cue is this? And then you have to get up, take your headphones off, and go out and ask, which is kind of embarrassing. But it may be that they're already counting in. You know, so it's like, and then you, when you pull the cue up, you realize that you don't have the right guitar. So you've got to be so much kind of in that moment of being on the ball, and you just don't know about that if you've never had that experience. You know, you're in this huge soundstage with an 80-piece orchestra and you're stuck in the corner and nobody's really paying attention to you. You know, you have to learn really fast, which is what I did.
A quote from you was, you were once noodling side stage and Paul walked up to you and said, "Show me those Norwegians."
And actually we were in the studio.
Oh, okay.
And I said, Norwegians? He said, yeah, Norwegian fjords. I'd never heard that Cockney rhyming slang for chords. Norwegian, yeah, Norwegian fjords.
What were the chords you were playing? Can you remember?
I have no recollection.
He didn't use them then?
He could have.
He might have done. In regards to, I'm glad you spoke about recording. Have you ever heard of red light syndrome? I don't know if that's translated.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that, or how would you advise someone who kind of tightens up a bit?
And it's tough, because the only advice I can give is that imagination is really like your best friend with all of this on many levels. If you find something that's difficult to play, don't sit there looking at your fingers trying to force them into the right position. Close your eyes and picture them doing it right. If you're really, you know, if you're really starting to freeze up, just close your eyes and imagine yourself doing it perfectly. You know, it's kind of a psychological thing. You just start using a different part of your brain. But it's easy to freeze up, you know, but you kind of have to, you have to leap into the great unknown. You know, it's really, you know, it's not, and you kind of build up a certain kind of, like a, at least in that moment, build up a certain self-confidence, you know, and I find that my best work is the stuff that I do when I'm not thinking about it. So find a distraction, you know. It's like, if you're on stage and you start get nervous, you know, I play for the exit sign, you know, way in the back of the auditorium. I just, you know, I project it out. So it's, you know, so you're not just dealing with the mechanics, but you actually start to use, you can see the bigger picture and use your imagination and just kind of build up your confidence that way. By, you know, so if you have to launch into a solo, just imagine it being a great solo.
You talked about being a solo performer, that you learned a lot from stand-up comedians, which I was very interested in. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, just I used to hang out at Catch a Rising Star in New York, which is a comedy club, and watch comedians on stage dealing with an audience by themselves. You know, and it's not just the comedians, magicians too. You know, where it's just one person engaging an audience with a certain kind of skill set. Another thing I learned a lot from was doing comedy improv classes, with the process of adding information, and not to deny something. It's, you know, you don't say, if somebody says, "Oh, look at that red door," you don't say, "It's not red, it's yellow." You then say, yeah, it matches your eyes or whatever. You know, you add some information to that, which may be funny or it may, you know, progress a story. And, you know, especially now, the more as time goes on and I get more and more into improvisational stuff on guitar, that kind of stuff really, I think, is useful information, to, you know, useful experiences to be able to relate to people who aren't operating in music, but operating in other forms of entertainment.
You started at 11 and had a great success in your career. How do you think you'll view, fast forward 30 years from now, how will you view this part of your career, and how will you review your career as a musician?
Well, hopefully I'll be around 30 years. I'll be in my 90s at that point. You know, it's progress. I mean, it's a process. I don't look at it in terms of, okay, I've kind of, you know, I can rest on my laurels, because there's always something new to learn, and there's always something new and different to express. And as technology changes, as the world changes, as the audience changes, you know, I try to adapt and accommodate all of that. You know, my ambition, I guess, to sum it up, would be that I always wanted to be one of those guitar guys, you know, and if I can continue to be one of those guitar guys and command a certain kind of respect for what I do, then I think that, you know, I will have succeeded in what I set out to do, which was to have a life as a guitar player. You know, it's one of the reasons I called the new album Fingerboard Road, because I live on Fingerboard Road, you know, and it's there's a satisfaction that goes along with that. There's also, I mean, and this is something that all musicians experience, there's a certain amount of frustration that can happen simply because you do things that really don't get recognized, don't get appreciated. You don't, maybe you don't get the credit for something. I mean, the biggest selling album I ever played on was the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. You know, but the musicians are not credited on there. And those credits really are important. I mean, it's one of the things that has kind of got lost in the digital era is musician credits, where it used to be that I would go out of my way to find out who was playing on the records, and I'd read the liner notes, you know. But now, you know, if they're there, they're too small to read anyway.
You've been stage left to some of the greatest living musicians. The time you were in the Wings was obviously, I think, was it 78 to 80? Is that right?
81,
right, okay.
It didn't officially break up till April of 81.
So obviously John Lennon passed away in December 1980, so you were kind of around Paul around that time. What do you recall of him speaking about John in that period running up beforehand and then afterwards?
Well, you know, I mean, it was always coloured often by the discussions being in relation to Yoko, because Paul and Yoko did not have a good relationship at that time. And I can only say that, you know, I mean, the way that he reacted to John's death was, I mean, it was deep. It was really too deep for the media to be able to grasp, because it's, their relationship had just so much nuance to it, you know. And it was, I mean, I think that there was always this kind of rivalry between them in terms of their creativity, and whose band it was. And, you know, it started off as John's band and then Paul kind of took over. But I think there was also, I mean, and this is my opinion, I mean, there was clearly a great love, you know, kind of, they've been in the trenches together. I mean, you don't go through what they went through without having, you know, being brothers in arms, kind of thing.
Thank you for answering that. And just quickly on working with George and Ringo.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ringo is just so much fun to play with because he's such a great drummer. And working with Paul and Ringo together was really cool, because there I am with half the Beatles, you know, with the Beatles rhythm section. And I love Ringo's drumming because, as I said, you know, he plays the song. So, and that makes it a lot easier as a musician to kind of follow the shape of what's going on. George was a delight. It was an unusual circumstance because I went straight from, I mentioned my daughter Ilse, who has been working with Robin Schultz. The day she was born, I went straight from the hospital to the studio to work with George. And he was just such a nice guy and just very easy to work with. And liked talking about the Beatles. I mean, he talked about the Beatles as a fan. You know, so... And a very, very underrated musician. I mean, what he accomplished as a songwriter and as a lead guitar player, and how his playing evolved, especially when he started introducing not just the sitar part of it, but the slide guitar, and using kind of Indian nuances in his slide guitar playing, and how that fused with rock and roll is really, you know, a great legacy from him.
And I'm really interested, actually, just quickly, that when you played lead guitar for George Harrison, did you feel...
I didn't play lead for George.
Oh, okay. What did you... Well, rhythm yeah, for George, right, okay.
I couldn't imagine playing lead for George.
Okay, so, I mean, the relationship of playing with him, did you feel that you had to play in a particular style? Did you, or was he dictating it to you?
Just played the song. You know, you play the song and you find the place where what you do, you know, fits.
Great. Okay, we'll wrap up there. So you're playing some gigs in the next few weeks. I see Seattle, Santa Cruz, Redwood City, Atlanta. You're always touring. Where can we find out more about the stuff you're doing?
My website is laurencejuber.com, laurencejuber.com. My book Guitar with Wings has my history, you know, kind of through the Wings period, but then with a wrap up of the next 30 years in 12 pages. And the website is a good place. There's also a link there to subscribe to my email list. And I, you know, like once a month or so, I'm putting out an e-blast. And you know, there's plenty of videos out there on the YouTubes.
And we could buy your guitar. You designed a guitar as well, is that right?
Yeah, but those are hard to find.
Okay.
And Martin. Yeah, I do have a signature guitar with Martin. Not too many of them made it over to the UK. Mostly they're in the US and in Japan. And perhaps we might be able to do another one next year. We'll see. I mean, I've done multiple versions of it. And it's, you know, when you're dealing with high-end guitars like that, it's a very specific kind of market. But it's been a great honor to be associated with them. They're really kind of an interesting and old world company. I mean, they've been in business since 1833. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fantastic. Is there anything else you want to add, Lawrence? Any other stories or anything like that?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. And if you could email me your address, I will send you a copy of Fingerboard Road.
Oh, wonderful. I will do that this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank
See you, Lawrence.
It's a pleasure.
Cheers. Bye-bye.